Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a report from the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists based on files from insiders at the Swiss branch of the British bank HSBC, revealing the bank provided extensive services to wealthy customers, including politicians, royalty, soccer and tennis pros, Hollywood actors, rock stars, dictators, arms dealers and criminal bosses, enabling them to avoid paying taxes and conceal millions in assets. William Black, the former chief prosecutor who investigated the savings and loan disaster and is the author of The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One, joins us to discuss the list of 100,000 clients with accounts containing $120 billion. Then we'll look into the White House meeting between President Obama and German Chancellor Merkel ahead of her planned meeting on Wednesday with the leaders of France, Russia, and Ukraine. A specialist on German security policy, Thomas Berger, Professor of International Relations at Boston University, joins us to discuss the different security cultures in Germany and the US, highlighted by contentious exchanges at the recent security conference in Munich between Angela Merkel and Senators Lindsey Graham and John McCain. Then finally, we will speak with Rebecca Bournet, Senior Policy Counsel at the Center for Responsible Lending, who focuses on regulatory and policy issues, in particular payday lenders. She joins us to discuss recent moves by the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to rein in the abusive practices of payday lenders, a $46 billion industry that charges up to 400% interest and hooks poor people on loan after loan to pay off earlier loans. We will also look into how the prospect of a new federal rule is driving payday lenders to lobby state legislators in Kentucky, Washington, and New Mexico, where they have tapped former Governor Jerry Apodaca as one of their lobbyists. And joining me now is William K. Black, who is the former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, who investigated the savings and loan disasters of the 1980s. Currently, he's a professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and was the executive director of the Institute for Fraud Prevention from 2005 to 2007. He's the author of the best-selling book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Black.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
And, Bill, the idea that this is the tip of the iceberg, and in fact, the consortium of investigative journalists, the International Consortium, have barely scratched the surface. Apparently, there's a subsequent report coming out in the spring, but already 60 Minutes did a piece on it, and Panorama, the BBC investigative program, also did a piece on Monday. So there's obviously more to come, but just having a list of 100,000 clients with accounts containing $120 billion and apparently hiding $204.5 billion in assets from tax authorities in 203 countries. So in other words, this has got to be a lot bigger than this, just this little window into the Swiss branch of HSBC.
Yes, although I would say this is not a little window, but a further demonstration that these large banks are simply criminal enterprises. This is the second very large revelation by this consortium. The earlier one was on Luxembourg, which it turned out was a let's make a deal quasi-state in which you could secretly come in and meet with a particular government official who had the authority to virtually eliminate your corporate income tax. And he proceeded to do so many hundreds of times. And it turns out that leak was from PricewaterhouseCoopers, one of the big four audit firms. But again, it revealed that many of the top corporations in the world were evading taxation through these scam deals with Luxembourg. And by the way, the person who was in charge, first as finance minister and then as prime minister, is now Juncker, running basically the EU. So what happens when you do the work of the sleaze for the largest banks and corporations? You get elevated to the most powerful political positions.
Well, that would seem to be the case with the former head of HSBC, its chairman, Stephen Green, who is now a Conservative politician in the UK government. And this is, by the way, HSBC is the world's second largest bank. So this is a big deal. And he apparently has
it
not.
It is, and he was made a peer as well. Mm-hmm. And he, on top of that, HSBC is the bank that did massive money laundering for one of the most vicious drug cartels in the world, the Sinaloa cartel in Mexico, where there was evidence that they were so accommodating that the drug cartel had actually built these containers to take mass amounts of cash that would perfectly fit the drive-up windows at the HSBC branches in Mexico.
Well, that settlement that HSBC paid to the Treasury was almost $2 billion, $1.9 billion, for their money laundering. That happened in 2012. But what's extraordinary, though, about the findings from this investigative consortium leaked by a bank former insider, the extent to which the bank, they just weren't offering advice. They were proactive. They were saying, well, we'll do this for you and we'll do this for you. And you should, you know, I mean, it's pretty extraordinary.
Well, it is extraordinary, but it is the same thing that HSBC and Standard Chartered did to evade sanctions on mass murderers and sanctions designed to prevent at least the alleged development of nuclear weapons in Iran, where they actually had training manuals that instructed the employees how to remove data that would alert U.S. authorities to it being a sanction violation. And so this wasn't routine, you know, it wasn't some crazed rogue operation. This was how you were trained as a new employee. And of course, HSBC was also involved in the other scams involving LIBOR and foreign exchange. These are the largest of financial frauds in the history of the world, and it's just one after another. And you brought up correctly the whistleblower in this circumstance. So the other story is that it isn't just that in the UK context, for example, that the Tories made the former HSBC person one of their cabinet ministers and made him appear. They also sat on this information, which was given to them by the whistleblowers. And they have prosecuted exactly one person, one of these tax evaders, even though they've had this information for up, in some cases, up to 7 years.
And again, I'm speaking with William Black, who is the former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, who investigated the savings and loan disaster of the 1980s and currently is a professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He was the executive director of the Institute for Fraud Prevention from 2005 to 2007 and is the author of the best-selling book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. But the names, there's apparently a list of 63 public figures, which I haven't been able to find this list. But they, as I said in the opening, they a cross-sanction of sports stars, royalty, politicians, criminals, arms dealers, etc. King of Jordan, the King of Morocco, the Sultan of Oman, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's cousin, the Rami Makhouf, who is, of course, the bagman for the family, among them. Is this? But what's extraordinary is that this happened back in 2005 to 2007, and I think the bank told everybody that this data was missing, didn't they? So these people have had a chance to sort of get their story together, right?
Right. So this is also means that it's a political issue the opposite direction in the United Kingdom context, where Nick Clegg is attacking Labour, for example, right now, on the grounds that, well, most of the underlying frauds occurred while Labour was in power. And so you folks are actually the folks who are guilty. And, of course, all of them just absolutely all of them have refused to enforce the law. And you are quite correct. This reads very much like the older folks will remember the Bank of Crook and Criminals International, as it was called by regulators, BCCI, which was it would simply fund anything, hide anything for the world's greatest kleptocrats and mass murderers. And that's what HSBC has become and has been for a minimum of a decade. And by the way, the Swiss, the only people that the Swiss government are trying to prosecute is the whistleblower.
Right, and they're basically saying that they're not collaborating with the European and the French legal system on the grounds that the information involved was stolen.
So it would be dishonorable to go after mass murderers and the world's worst organized criminals and drug gangs, because after all, once they stole it, they stole it fair and square.
Right. And that the information about them was stolen, and therefore we can't act on it. I mean, it's pretty extraordinary.
And of this, course, if it's not stolen, you can't act on it because you don't know it.
Right.
And so, it's a catch-22, so, in which the crooks always win.
So these, as what we know so far is that of these 100,000 clients with $120 billion and what $204.5 billion in hidden assets are from various countries: Switzerland, the UK, Venezuela, and the US and France. The U.S., I think, has got a substantial number. I mean, I think it's about, $15 billion worth of hidden money. But again, where would you put that in terms of the tip of the iceberg?
Well, again, the big story out of all of this is, remember when they claimed that there was tax evasion because taxes were too high, and that if we brought down the marginal tax rate for rich Americans, they would have this kumbaya moment, and they would bring back their foreign money, and they would pay their taxes finally and such? Well, that was all completely a lie. This was in the era of the Bush tax cuts that most of this was occurring in the United States. In fact, all of it currently disclosed was occurring. So this was at a time of record low taxes, and the wealthy were unwilling to pay even record low taxes. So if you want to know a further reason why income inequality and wealth inequality has surged through much of the world, it's this combination of greatly reducing the marginal tax rates and then just allowing whole-scale tax evasion by the wealthiest people with complete impunity, even when the list of who evaded the taxes was made public and given to the tax authorities.
And the fact that you have these royalty and politicians and sports and media movie and rock stars, celebrities, etc., their funds are also intermingled with arms dealers and dictators and traffickers in blood diamonds. I think that was the only guy that the Brits went after. And then, of course, in this current list is this character on one of the many on the U.S. sanctions list over the war in Ukraine, Gennady Timchenko, who's a crony of President Vladimir Putin. So his Volga group has been also named in it. So it's
genocidal folks in South Sudan. There is literally no one too dirty that HSBC didn't want them as a client.
So how then do you, if you got the wealthy and these celebrities, and I guess they're going to be named and shamed, rubbing shoulders in the sense that their deposits are commingled with these thugs, will this naming shaming be effective? I mean, what's going to come out?
First, remember, the government was absolutely unwilling to name and shame them. This list, again, has been out and given to the governments of the world for years. and they have refused to do anything about it. So the obvious question is, why does HSBC still exist? Was it not put into receivership years ago? It has now had something like 37 bites of the apple in terms of different frauds.
Well, remember that during the Clinton years, when Senator Phil Graham of Texas was the big champion of deregulating Wall Street and deregulating the banks, and it led to getting rid of the Glass-Steagall Act? When Phil Graham, first job he got when he left the U.S. Senate was with HSBC.
And the rationale for why the United States had to supposedly adopt Glass-Steagall was that we were losing the competition internationally against the universal banks, like the German banks, and most particularly like HSBC and then RBS.
So I guess it's too late to do anything about the Phil Grahams of this world. But, I mean, they are the ultimate criminal enablers, aren't they? I mean, think of the damage that the 2008 crash did, which you can trace directly to lifting the Glass-Steagall Act.
Right. So, again, we talk in criminology about the concept of a criminogenic environment. This is an environment in which the incentives become so perverse because you can steal so much with complete impunity that fraud becomes not simply common, but actually endemic in your most elite institutions. So that's what they've done. In the U.S. context alone, the estimated losses by economists are $21 trillion. A trillion is 1,000 billion. $21 trillion in lost GDP and 10 million American jobs. And both of those figures are much, much bigger in Europe because of austerity.
So Stephen Green, the Tory cabinet minister, former head of the bank, when all this hiding of money, tax dodging and asset hiding went on, nothing's going to happen to him. Phil Graham is in a splendid retirement, I imagine. All of these dictators and celebrities have all moved to another bank by now, I guess.
And the United States and the Serious Fraud Office in the UK context have refused to prosecute any of the really elite bankers. In the U.S., we refuse to prosecute even the non-elite bankers. The Brits actually, in the United States, have a handful out of LIBOR and such of relatively minor players and such. So all of this is a complete change from our era when we put over 1,000 of these folks got felony convictions, over 800 of them imprisoned and such. And it, of course, every time HSBC gets away with this, it just encourages their officers to commit bigger and badder frauds. And you can see there's simply no ethical constraints.
Well, William Black, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. I'd leave you simply with there's been an international race to the bottom with the theory that if we're too tough, the banks will go to the City of London and vice versa. And everybody loses when you have that kind of race. Except, of course, the crooked bankers.
Well, I thank you again, William K. Black. And I've just been speaking with William K. Black, who's a former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, who investigated the savings and loan disasters of the 1980s and currently is a professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He was the executive director of the Institute for Fraud Prevention and is the author of the best-selling book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the different security culture, if you will, between the United States and Germany. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Thomas Berger, who's a professor of international relations at Boston University. He specializes in German and Japanese politics, international relations and comparative government and political culture, and is the author of War, Guilt, and World Politics After World War II, and Cultures of Anti-Militarism, National Security in Germany and Japan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Berger.
Hello, good to be with you.
And obviously, there's been some contention prior to Chancellor Angela Merkel meeting with President Obama in the White House at the recent security conference in Munich. There was Senator Lindsey Graham and John McCain took a great exception to what Angela Merkel had said. Today at the White House, the president went to great length to say there wasn't any distance between the two countries. And of course, on Wednesday, at least it's planned that Angela Merkel, the French president, the Russian president, and the Ukrainian president will meet in Minsk, Belarus, perhaps come up with some kind of deal. So let's begin with whether or not there really are differences here between these two countries in their approach to Putin and the war in Ukraine.
Well, there are and there aren't. I mean, I would be very much remiss if I didn't point out the United States and its European partners, including Germany, share some very common perspectives and broad interests with respect to the situation in Ukraine. We all agree, and I think we're quite sincere in this, that what Putin has been doing in the Ukraine represents a challenge to the post-Cold War international order in Europe. Borders should not be redrawn as they have been, and neighbors should not be stirring up trouble in each other's backyards the way Putin has been doing. And I also think that there's probably a general shared preference for trying to find a negotiated solution. However, there is a difference between the different sides and how to respond to the challenge that Putin is posing. I think, in general, the Europeans would prefer to have a more laid-back, a more patient approach to trying to deal with Putin, and one that does not needlessly escalate the situation beyond what it already is. And I think, on the other hand, in the United States, we are clearly having a kind of growing chorus of voices who favor a more muscular approach, one which would provide not only financial and economic support and diplomatic support for President Petroshenko in the Ukraine, but also would provide, I think the term of art nowadays is lethal aid, i.e. weapons and strategic assistance to the Ukrainian forces fighting the separatists and their Russian backers.
Well, it's difficult, though, not to notice that there is a subtext, at least here in the United States. In Germany, it seems that there is genuine bipartisanship in the sense that Angela Merkel heads up a coalition of her conservative party with the socialist opposition, and they appear to be completely aboard her foreign policy. Here in the United States, the Republicans have this jihad against President Obama, and there's nobody more vocal in criticizing his foreign policy than Senators McCain and Lindsey Graham. I mean, it's not even a subtext. They overtly accuse Obama of being a wimp and not standing up for America.
Well, I think you're absolutely correct that there is a element of partisan politics involved in the current attacks on Obama's policy. I would also point out, by the way, that there are tensions inside of Germany between the Social Democrats, who in general have had a more kind of engagement towards Russia and in earlier days the Soviet Union, and the Christian Democrats, which is Angela Merkel's party, Chancellor Angela Merkel's party. However, I think underlying this is not only, you know, the personalities and the sort of domestic political constellations in the two countries at the moment, but also I think a sort of deeper rooted difference in the strategic worldview or strategic culture of the two countries.
Well, explain that further then, because Angela Merkel tried to explain that with her story about growing up in East Germany and the Berlin Wall, and John McCain took great exception to what she said.
Well, Angela Merkel grew up in East Germany. She actually was born the same year as the Berlin Wall was erected, or she was very young when the Berlin Wall was erected. And she lived much of her adult life in East Germany, and she saw
and she experienced that a policy of containment and patience paid off, that in the end, the West was able to triumph over the Soviet Union without engaging in a cataclysmic confrontation. And but that worldview, which is rooted in her personal experiences, is, I think, more broadly shared among German political elites, both the left and the right persuasion, both those who grew up in East Germany and the large majority who were in West Germany. And I think that perspective is really rooted in differences between Germany and the United States in terms of their capabilities, their strategic location, and I think the particular lessons and experiences that they have had of the previous century. Just very briefly, I mean, and this is true also, by the way, of many of our other European partners, especially in continental Europe, people who do not have a strong hand, who do not have strong military capabilities, tend to favor and emphasize those abilities which they have, which are primarily, in the case of the Europeans, diplomatic and economic. So there's a sort of natural tendency to go in that direction. Also, one might add that Europeans are dealing with a strategic crisis which is very near to them, and they are going to have to live with the consequences of what is going to happen in a way that the United States is more less likely to have to do. But then in addition to that, I think that there is a sort of different understanding of history which we see at play here. In the United States, we tend to emphasize very much the experience of the Munich Conference in 1938, the Munich crisis, which was when the British and French leaders did not stand up to the Nazi aggression invasion of Czechoslovakia. And the lesson that we have drawn from that particular experience is that when we are confronted with a tyrant, we have to respond forcefully. Otherwise, we'll create an incentive for them to repeat and expand their pattern of aggression. If only we had stopped Hitler in 1938, the World War II might have been avoided. On the other hand, the Europeans, especially the continental Europeans, seem to go back a little bit further and emphasize the experiences of 1914, the crisis in Sarajevo, and when the Archduke Ferdinand of Austria-Hungary was assassinated. And in that particular instance, different European powers, Austria-Hungary, Russia, Germany, France, in the first instance, took a very hard line in response to a minor crisis. And it led to an uncontrolled sort of spiral of events, an escalation which plunged the entire continent into a war which could have been avoided. So the Europeans have drawn, look at a different historical instance and draw almost the opposite lesson.
Again, I'm speaking with Thomas Berg, who's a professor of international relations at Boston University. He specializes in German and Japanese politics, international relations, and comparative government in East Asia and political culture. And he's the author of War, Guilt, and World Politics After World War II and Cultures of Anti-Militarism, National Security in Germany and Japan. So, Thomas, I spoke yesterday with the independent defense analyst in Moscow, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, who writes for Novaya Gazeta, which is about the only newspaper left in Russia that's not controlled by Putin. And he made the point, and I tend to think, you know, he's closer to the scene. I tend to take him fairly seriously, that Putin simply won't give up until he brings down this government. He wants a government that's compliant, and in the case of the last guy, completely corrupt, like his government is completely corrupt. But his bottom line is, you know, forget about joining Europe, forget about democracy, rule of law. I want to control this part of the world, and you've stepped too far, NATO, into my backyard. And he's got all the resources and the time in the world to do it. So when talking about the Munich with Chamberlain holding up the piece of paper about peace in our time and the whole obsession with the appeasement, is that then the ultimate situation, that you just have to appease Putin because he's determined and we're not?
Well, Putin, of course, from his perspective, is responding to challenges which are coming from the West. I mean, he sees what's going on in the Ukraine as a part of a whole chain of Western provocations, events going back, frankly, to the end of the Cold War. There's, in general, and this is not just Putin, there is the view in Russia that Gorbachev made a mistake, miscalculated. He thought he could make a deal with the United States and the Western allies. He thought that Russia would become a sort of equal partner of the United States. And what happened in the subsequent 10 years was that Russia gave up its empire and was ignored in the West. It was ignored in over Yugoslavia, the Christ wars in Bosnia-Herzegovina, in Kosovo. It did not benefit economically in the way that was anticipated. And moreover, the West continued to expand. NATO was expanded into the territory of the former Warsaw Pact, into the Russian Imperium in Eastern Europe. It expanded into the former Soviet Union itself when we brought in the Baltic states. And he saw the sort of growing influence of the West in the Ukraine as yet the next step in that process, that the West is dismembering. I'm not saying I'm agreeing with his particular point of view, but that is the way it is perceived by Putin and many others in the Russian sphere. So he feels he is cornered by the West and has to respond. Now, also, and this is the other point which I think your other interlocutor in Moscow has made, Putin holds a lot of cards in this situation. He has formidable military resources. The Russian army, which almost disintegrated after the Cold War, has reformed. It's not quite what it used to be, not by a long shot, but it's still a very capable military. It has elements which are very capable. He has, it's right in his backyard, so he has lots of points of entry into the Ukraine and into Ukrainian politics. There is a large Russian-speaking minority in Ukraine, many of whom seem to be genuinely sympathetic to Moscow. He has the ability to escalate, both in the Ukraine, militarily and politically, but also outside of the Ukraine. One of the nightmares which the European leaders, including Merkel, have is that he may, in response to our providing lethal aid in the Ukraine, he may decide to create a crisis elsewhere, for example, in the Baltic states, which are NATO members. And that would be a real challenge to the credibility of the entire NATO alliance, the Western alliance. He could respond by potentially creating diplomatic problems in other parts of the world. Russia has influence in North Korea. It has influence with, in Syria, in Iran. So there's a lot that could happen. And in the language of sort of strategic analysis, Russia seems to have what they call escalation dominance. For every move that we can make, he can escalate even further. And how far we want to go in terms of challenging Putin, I don't know. Now, does that mean that we have to give up on the Ukraine? Well, perhaps in the short run, we can't quite do everything we would like. But I think the point of view which is held by the Europeans, at least, is that in the long run, the cards are in our favor. Putin can win this round, but he's wrecking his economy. The population, the mood, especially among educated young Russians, is absolutely dismal. Young people are trying to leave, moving to New York, moving to Berlin, if they absolutely have an opportunity. And if we wait long enough, and this again reflects Chancellor Merkel's own personal experiences, Putin, this sort of mini Soviet Union that he's trying to create, will collapse just like the old one did.
Well, it does seem, Thomas Berger, that we have the worst of all possible worlds here. On the one hand, we talked about the idea of the Munich analogy of selling out the Ukrainians. But on the other hand, Putin and the Russians' genuine fear of encroachment from NATO, which many analysts have suggested, including Henry Kissinger, that the U.S. and the Europeans did not sufficiently take into account Russia's security needs. So there's no question that the Russians feel this way, and that Putin's support, his enormous support inside the country, has to reflect some of that that fear of encroachment. But the encroachment is largely illusionary. And when you say that if Putin goes after the Baltic states, which have Article 5 protection under NATO, I recall that the Polish foreign minister said NATO was a joke. You know, he referred to the activity that Monica Lewinsky was involved in, that's all it is, as far as Poland is expected to do to the United States. So that's what worries me, is that all of this stuff is about a perception of a paper tiger against a real army. And I think, as I say, I think we have the worst of both possible worlds, don't we?
Well, I would be a little bit careful, I think. I mean, the Poles have their own very difficult history with Russia and the Russians with the Poles, and there is there's an added element of animosity. But there are reasons why Poland, among others, was very, very eager to join NATO, and it's because NATO is the biggest, it's the only game in town. And while NATO has in many ways been suffering a lot of difficulties in recent years, especially in connection to the out-of-area operations in Afghanistan, it's still the biggest and most successful alliance in history, and it is backed by American, British, French, and even, I should add, German military and economic power. So I don't think it's a paper tiger, but it can be tested. And one of the things that one of the challenges that the United States faces moving forward is trying to hold together this alliance to meet this particular challenge, because we do have different views. We do also have different concrete interests, political and geostrategic. And we, at the same time, have to find a way to create a common approach in dealing with Russia, because otherwise Putin will try to use the differences that exist within the alliance to pull us apart.
Well, but let me ask you this, Thomas Berger. Would the German people be prepared to go to war against Russia over any of these countries? And the same would apply to the United States. I don't know that the American people are prepared to go to war against Russia over the Baltics. They don't even know these states. I mean, you know, that's the part of it that I find a little bit surreal. But, of course, you know, nuclear weapons are real, and Russia has a whole generation of new mobile nuclear weapons.
Yes, they do.
So, you know, again, it feels like the worst of all possible worlds.
Well, I mean, this is unfortunately a bit of a blast from the past. We faced this kind of situation before, both in Europe and elsewhere, when the U.S., the Soviet Union was much larger and was much more capable. The Soviet military was larger and more capable than what Putin has. But still, we do have a basic reality, which is that we have a formidable, capable military, capable, able to launch both low-intensity and high-intensity, like the kind that we're seeing right now, and high-intensity military operations. And it is backed by a government which has thousands of nuclear weapons. On the other hand, of course, we also have a large military, and we also have thousands of nuclear weapons. And what basically you wind up engaged in is a kind of balance, not of just power, but a balance of fear, a balance of threat. Neither side wants to do the insane thing, which is to actually start using these weapons against each other. But both of them have a strong incentive not to give in to each other, and they play a game of chicken. Who will blink first? We've done this before. The Cuban Missile Crisis is the most famous example of this. We don't do this lightly, but we have to make a determination at what point are enough critical interests at stake that we are willing to play that kind of game with Russia. I don't think, in the end, the United States is willing to do that. Even those people like Lindsey Graham and John McCain, as well as the authors of a recent think tank piece calling for more robust action in the Ukraine, I don't think any of them would really want to do that for the Ukraine. I do think we would do that if NATO credibility is at stake, because if we give up on the Baltic states, if we give up on Poland, then we're going to wind up giving up on all of Europe. And
well, Thomas,
we won't do that.
Well, Thomas Berger, I thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Pleasure to talk to you.
And again, I've been speaking with Thomas Berger, Professor of International Relations at Boston University, specializing in German and Japanese politics, international relations, and comparative government and political culture. He's the author of War, Guilt, and World Politics After World War II, and Cultures of Anti-Militarism, National Security in Germany and Japan. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the $46 billion predatory payday lender industry.
And the meddlers, they buy and they sell. They destroyed your city. They'll destroy you as well. The lecherous and treacherous, a hair meant for the weather. Each of them bigger than all men put together. Sluggers and muggers wearing fancy gold.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Rebecca Bornet, who's a senior policy counsel at the Center for Responsible Lending, where she focuses on regulatory and policy issues relating to consumer credit and payday loans. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rebecca Bornet.
Thanks for having me.
And in terms of payday loans, and of course, the point about them is that their interest rates are so high that even the mafia would be embarrassed to ask for 300% interest. And a lot of American consumers are being caught up in this web. I think a lot of it's to do with the lack of alternatives in the banking sphere. But they also seem to have a very powerful lobby in Washington. So how much do you think this new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is going to move against them? Because, you know, they're a bit like the for-profit college industry. They have a powerful lobby, and every time attempts have been made to weigh in their deceptive practices, they've come up against a brick wall. So give us a sense about the legislative battle going on now to rein in payday loans.
Sure. So you're right that the payday lending industry does have a very well-funded and well-organized lobby. They have in the states for many years, and they do these days at the federal level as well. You know, for many years, really payday lending has only been regulated at the state level. And it was the lobby about 20 or 30 years ago that sort of created the space for payday loans. They went around to state legislators back in the 90s and kind of made the case that they shouldn't be subject to state usury limits because their loan was just a very short-term emergency loan. You know, it wasn't really credit. It was just sort of a quick cash advance. And so they did succeed, the lobby then, in getting carve-outs from state usury limits in about probably a little over two-thirds of the states. In more recent years, states have decided that experiment didn't really work so well, and several states have put those protections back in place. So now at the federal level, we have a new Consumer Bureau that you mentioned. You know, it's interesting that the one tool that's worked the best in the states to address payday lending is a usury limit. In states with sort of a reasonable double-digit state interest caps, payday lending hasn't thrived because, as you mentioned, they like interest rates in the 400% range. So the Bureau cannot set an interest rate limit. That was put forth in the Wall Street Reform Act. They don't have that authority. But there is one kind of a real fundamental thing that they can do, which we hope they will do, which is to just require that a lender determine a borrower's ability to repay a loan before they make the loan. It sounds kind of simple, but it's sort of a novel concept when it comes to payday lending, where the whole industry is really driven by the fact that most loans are made to borrowers who can't repay, and who, you know, get a loan for $300 today. In 2 weeks, they can't pay it back, so the lender says, "That's all right, just pay us another fee." So they pay the 2 weeks of interest again, on average 10 or 11 times a year without reducing the principal at all, and they get stuck.
Well, isn't that the tragedy of this phenomenon of payday lending? Apparently, what is it, something like 75% of the fees generated come from people who find themselves having to get loans upon loans to churn them over, borrowing, taking out at least 11 or more loans each year. And that accounts for roughly 75% of the fees generated. So that seems to be the trap. In other words, if you borrow money because you're desperate, and then you find yourself unable to pay the usurious interest, so you borrow more money, right?
That's exactly right. You know, somebody who, and the data has shown that, you know, the payday lenders like to say that their loans go to people who are in a quick emergency, and they help people out in a quick emergency. But what the data has really shown in recent years, where just more and more data has become available, like it has in many, you know, spaces, and the data show that most borrowers aren't having a short-term emergency. They're having ongoing problem where their expenses exceed their income. And so that's the very borrower who most likely cannot afford a two-week 400% interest rate loan. And so, as you mentioned, I mean, what the loans end up doing is sort of taking people who are already desperate and just stripping them of whatever, you know, excess funds they may have week after week after week for most of the year.
Again, I'm speaking with Rebecca Bornet, who's a senior policy analyst at the Center for Responsible Lending, where she focuses on regulatory and policy issues related to consumer credit, in particular payday loans. And this is an industry that's grown to roughly $46 billion a year industry. And going back to one of my original questions, I know I fired a whole broadside at you, Rebecca, in the beginning there. But my sense is that there's a problem in this country in general with banking, access to banking for low-income and minority communities. It used to be, through the 1960s, as a matter of fact, that the post office provided banking. And that, I think, took care of a lot of problem that exists today. And the fact that there aren't any banking facilities or banking access to banks in minority communities and a lot of rural communities in the country, has that led to the growth of this phenomenon of payday lending?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I think that, you know, you point to an important problem, which is that a lot of people with limited resources find themselves with, you know, not very many places to turn. I think that it's important to view credit as only one possible solution for financial shortfalls. And many times for those most desperate, credit is not the best option. Credit at a reasonable rate might be. There are credit cards, subprime credit cards even are far less expensive than payday loans. There are credit unions and banks who do make affordable small dollar loans for those who can demonstrate ability to, they make loans when they can determine that they're affordable for the borrower. But one thing that's been interesting in states that have experimented with payday lending and then decided that it's not what they wanted for their residents. In North Carolina, for example, when payday lending was again restricted, a banking commissioner study there showed that more reasonable alternatives were able to flourish more when triple-digit interest rate lenders were no longer able to. And so, you know, to some extent, what's happening here is that we have kind of bad credit driving out better credit. Because if lenders are permitted to charge these sort of astronomical rates, there's a lot less of incentive for them to find creative, efficient ways to be able to make affordable small dollar loans.
But I've seen many of these payday lending storefronts, and they're usually in mini malls, and sometimes they come and go. But what they usually have in the windows, along with payday lending, is these big signs up saying checks cashed. And that would indicate to me that if you need to have your paycheck cashed, that means you don't have a bank account. So that's why I brought up the question of, you know, why can't we find ways, as we used to have with post office banking, to make banking accessible to all Americans?
Well, it's interesting. One thing about payday lending is that while a lot of payday lenders do also cash checks, in order to get a payday loan, one of the few requirements that does exist is that the borrower has to have a checking account. And so by definition, a payday loan borrower is banked. They do have an account because the lender will only make the loan if they know that they can hold the borrower's post-dated check to deposit on that borrower's payday. Here in 2015, a lot of times it's electronic, and so the payday lender will have a borrower's banking and routing number, routing and checking account number, and debit the account on the payday. So what we find with payday lending is, in fact, many payday borrowers, I want to say one study was a fourth or a third of payday borrowers have actually had their checking account closed or closed their account because they got trapped in payday loans, and the only way they could eventually stop the payday lender from raiding their account essentially was to close it. So in terms of trying to ensure that, you know, the banking system is inclusive of all communities and that everyone has access to bank accounts, I mean, one step in the right direction would be to stop the payday lending debt trap that sort of only makes that problem worse by resulting in lost bank accounts.
So I recall Rebecca Bornay, again, the Senior Policy Counsel at the Center for Responsible Lending. I recall that, for example, General Petraeus's wife, Holly Petraeus, was able to get the White House and get a bill passed to restrict payday lenders around military bases. They were preying on servicemen and their families, and it's you know, I think they moved them back a mile or something. It wasn't like they put them out of business, but at least they stopped them being right at the sort of gate of the military base. Are there any other restrictions that could be added to the efforts of Holly Petraeus?
Well, yes. Yeah, so, you know, what you mentioned is actually happening right now. So the back in around 2008, the Congress did say that any loans to service members, military service members, had to be priced at 36% annual interest rate or less. That did result in a lot of improvements to loans being made to military service members in terms of payday loans, but at the same time, the regulations that were drawn subsequently to the statute, they were pretty narrowly drawn, and they didn't sort of, there's been a lot of evasions since then, as the payday lenders are known to do. They're pretty creative to kind of, you know, find ways around efforts to kind of rein them in. And so the DOD right now actually has just closed a public comment period where they proposed broadening those regulations under the Military Lending Act that would protect military borrowers not only from payday loans but also from very high-cost installment loans, which can often kind of have a lot of the same loan flipping and kind of chronic renewals that we see in the payday industry. So that protection is very important. It is statutory and it is a usury limit. And so, you know, as I mentioned, CFPB cannot do a usury limit for payday loans. But certainly, it seems like a reasonable place to start would be just to require a lender to look at a borrower's income and expenses. For most lower income borrowers, their primary expense will be their housing payment. So look at income, look at housing payment, and determine whether that borrower is going to be one that can repay the loan in 2 weeks or not. And so that's where we hope the bureau will go. And it seems like a very reasonable, you know, principle of lending that banks and credit unions and mortgage lenders and everyone else sort of typically abides by.
Well, apparently, though, with these federal regulations sort of cooking at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, apparently this has already set off a new round of lobbying from payday lenders to states, including Kentucky, Washington, and New Mexico. And in one case, they've tapped a former governor as a lobbyist. So walk us through, first of all, do you know who the governor is that's lobbying for the payday lenders?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I'm sure that one of my colleagues would know, but I don't. But I do know that, you know, this isn't a surprise. I mean, the payday lenders are anticipating action by the Consumer Bureau, and I think that that's part of why we hope that the Bureau will approach the payday lending reg real comprehensively, you know, the way that the Department of Defense is currently planning to do for military servicemen and women. And so what that means is, you know, not only looking at the way that these very short-term balloon payment loans impact people, but also sort of another variety of payday loans, which are multi-payment payday loans. So in some states, and this is what the payday lenders are trying to do more of to try to maybe get out from some of the stronger strong CFPB protections, they might make a 3 or a 6 month loan that's of a greater amount, but every 2 weeks they debit the borrower's checking account for a large amount of money. And again, we're talking in triple digit interest rates. So The structure of the loan is slightly different. It's longer term, but the biweekly payments basically mirror what a consumer would pay with a balloon payday loan. So in substance, it doesn't feel too different to the payday borrower. So we're hoping that the CFPB will be looking, you know, not only at the balloon payment loans, but also at longer term payday loans. Any loan where the lender is first in line for the borrower's checking account or for the title to the borrower's car, which is kind of another version of these payday loans, car title loans. In all those instances, you know, the lender has very little incentive to care whether the borrower can both repay the loan and afford to keep the lights on, you know, because they're first. They're first for repayment. And so what we hope is that the Bureau looks at all loans, single payment, multi-payment, and including car title, to sort of address the problem comprehensively, require an ability to repay assessment for all those loans, you know, in part in anticipation of the evasion efforts that we kind of expect from the state, from the payday lenders in the states.
So how many instances are there? What percentage of instances are there of consumers who get trapped with payday loans where they end up, say, borrowing $500 and paying several thousand back, and then on top of that they lose their car?
Yeah, so, you know, that is the, what you described there is what drives the business model. When we have, you know, we've heard quotes over the years of payday loan executives who basically say, like, the key is in the repeat borrowing. You know, the key is to get the borrower in and get them trapped. This isn't a model that operates according to how it sort of markets itself, which is as a short-term, quick emergency. The whole model really revolves around getting people in and getting them stuck. And it's all enabled because they're not required to figure out if the borrower can't repay. In fact, they have every incentive to get borrowers in who can't repay because those are the long-term borrowers that really support the model. Just really kind of points to the need to have a very basic, fundamental, upfront requirement that lenders determine if the loan's affordable or not.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Rebecca Bornay.
Thanks so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Rebecca Bornay, who's a senior policy counsel at the Center for Responsible Lending, where she focuses on regulatory and policy issues related to consumer credit and, in particular, payday loans. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.